Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Food, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Tippin, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Nico Slate about his new book, Gandhi's Search for the Perfect Diet, Eating with the World in Mind. Nico is professor of history and director of graduate studies at Carnegie Mellon University. Nico's work centers on histories of anti-racist activism, both in the United States and India. The book is actually one of two new books out right now. I encourage you to go over to the New Books in History channel to hear Nico talk about his other book, Lord Cornwallis is Dead, The Struggle for Democracy in the United States and India. Another fascinating conversation there. Nico Slate, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Carrie. It's a real pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks. Nico, let's start with maybe some background. Tell us a little bit about yourself and the origins of the book. Where did the project begin and what drew you to this aspect of Gandhi's life?
Maybe we should start actually with the fact that I grew up with a single mom who worked late and often very far away from home. And so at a relatively early age, I had to make my own way in the kitchen. And in addition to working, my mom was also an incredibly forgiving eater. And so I grew up with this overinflated sense of my own culinary skills. No matter what I made, no matter how simple it was, you know, basic tomato sauce or barbecue chicken with just barbecue sauce, my mom would rave endlessly about how amazing it was and how talented I was as a chef. And, you know, when you're a kid and you get that kind of positive affirmation, it often can make you really love something. And so from a pretty early age, I really loved cooking. I wasn't any good at it, but I really loved doing it. And as I got older, I also developed a pretty strong interest in nutrition. Maybe even you might say an obsession with nutrition. I'm one of these people who loves to read up on the latest nutrients and think about which foods to eat to maximize their nutritional benefit. And of course, Gandhi was someone who loved food and really loved nutrition. And so I saw in him a kindred spirit of sorts, someone whom I could learn from, sympathize with, empathize with, sometimes see myself in. And that's really what started the project for me.
One of the things that most interested me about the book is how much of the story you're able to tell in Gandhi's own words. So would you describe the archive that you were working with? Where is it? And where is he doing all this writing about diet? And how does it fit in with the rest of his published work?
You know, this is one of the most fun parts of this project for me, is that there is an amazing archive of Gandhi's thoughts and writings on food preserved in his collected works. His collected works are, I think, one of the greatest historical archives that exist, something like 98 volumes, 500 pages each, that contain not just all of his published writings, and Gandhi published a lot, but also his letters, his speeches, a lot of diary entries. And you can search through these things now digitally to find every reference to chocolate or almonds or milk or vitamin C or anything you're interested in. And you're able to see how Gandhi's thoughts on that particular subject evolve over time, how deeply contextualized they were. And often you get surprised, I was anyway, by some of the amazing things you find when you say search for ginger or cinnamon or chocolate. I mentioned chocolate twice, I think, actually, because that's one of my favorites. And you see that these nutritional ideas are, for Gandhi, really one of the key pillars of his entire life. They connected him to his politics, to his personal life, very powerfully to his religious and spiritual views. And so the main reason why you find so many rich things that Gandhi himself wrote about food and nutrition is that Gandhi himself saw how food and nutrition could be connected to every facet of his life.
Well, speaking of the sort of religious aspects of diet, one of the things I noticed was the chapter on vegetarianism. It seems like that's not only the longest lasting and most consistent part of his diet, but you write in there about how the Vegetarian Society in London seems like a really important proving ground for Gandhi, not just testing out his ideas about diet, but also about social justice and making his first public speeches and even getting his first publications in writing. So is it fair to say that the Gandhi we know gets his start here? What's so important about the vegetarian diet and his activism?
I think it is fair to say that, you know, if you look at it, when Gandhi comes to London in the early 1890s, he is a relatively affluent, young legal student who has only just barely gotten involved in anything political. And he's also very shy. He's a fairly quiet, reticent young man. And what vegetarianism does is it gives him a bridge between some of his deepest convictions, convictions that are formed in childhood and that are very profoundly spiritual and religious for him. It bridges those deep convictions with the world beyond, particularly the world of politics. And it encourages him to fight through his shyness, to, for example, give public speeches. And he writes, I think, quite movingly, actually, about how terrified he was the first few times he gave public speeches to these vegetarian audiences. But in many ways, they were the perfect audience for him because they already had this profound bond with him. And they were also weird, just like he was weird. You know, being vegetarian and that in Victorian England was a weird thing. And weird people often have lots of weird ideas. So they were against imperialism, which was also a weird thing at that point, right? And they're against capital punishment and therefore, you know, women's equality and in many cases against racism. And so there's this community of like-minded people that Gandhi's able to tap into quite naturally through his passion and commitment to vegetarianism. And that then empowers him as a political agent and also broadens his politics, I think contributes to his growing anti-imperialism and his views on many other subjects as well. So I think it's absolutely vital. And you see that actually for decades afterwards, vegetarian politics is one of the key things Gandhi's involved in. In fact, I think if you would have asked him, say, during his years in South Africa, when he's fighting against white racism in South Africa and fighting for the rights of Indian migrants there, what his key priorities were, I think vegetarianism would be up there near the top of the list. He was still very actively involved in fighting for vegetarianism in a variety of different ways. So for Gandhi, it's really a portal. It's an opening politically and also really a lifelong commitment. It's both for him.
Yeah. And you mentioned the community of people that he meets there. Who are some of those figures that are really important to both the future of his sort of diet investigations and experiments and all of the other kind of social activism he's working in?
So sort of the, if you will, the kind of grandfather of the vegetarian movement is a guy named Henry Salt. And I should preface this by saying I'm not great with names. Hopefully I'm not getting any first names wrong. I definitely remember his last name because, of course, it's profoundly ironic given that one of Gandhi's lifelong... Yeah, isn't it great? One of his lifelong obsessions is, of course, to reduce the amount of salt in his diet. And he then goes on to lead this profoundly important protest campaign, the Salt March or the Salt Satyagraha. So salt is a very important part of Gandhi's diet. It also happens to be the surname of this very important vegetarian figure. And Gandhi, you know, meets this man and is actually really profoundly moved by his writings. And there's a beautiful moment in Gandhi's autobiography where he talks about, you know, almost starving during the first few weeks that he's in England because he's not getting enough nutritious food and he's finding it very difficult to be vegetarian. And then he just happens upon this vegetarian restaurant. And the first thing he sees there is not food. I actually think it's important. The first thing he sees there is a book. It's a book by Salt about the history of vegetarianism and about vegetarianism and its current practice. And he buys this book and reads it while he's eating this vegetarian meal. So it's an intellectual introduction as well as a more personal one. There's a man named Oldfield who is actually one of Gandhi's roommates, which I find quite fascinating to imagine these two figures living together. Another key interesting person is a guy named Henry Pollack, P-O-L-A-K. I'm not actually sure how he would pronounce his name. One of the challenges being a historian is, of course, if your figures are dead, you can't ask them actually how right. they pronounce it. But he was a very influential political activist who spent a lot of time with Gandhi in South Africa. And they bonded on vegetarianism, but then also bonded on the struggle against racism in South Africa. And so you see all of these different figures. For one thing, they're not Indian, which I think is actually really important. Gandhi's diet and his nutritional interests were extraordinarily cosmopolitan, in large part because they're formed outside of India, in London first and then in South Africa. And that influences how Gandhi looks at the world. You know, his views on diet and nutrition are heavily steeped in Indian culinary traditions, but they're also in many ways broader than that, more cosmopolitan than that. And Gandhi will bring a similar openness to many facets of his life. I think that's one key important fact, is that many of these figures are not Indian. He's also inspired by many key campaigners, not just vegetarian, but people who are fighting for a variety of different issues. So it broadens him nationally, and it also broadens his sense of the issues or problems that he's seeing in the world.
So besides meat, what are some of the other foods that Gandhi abstained from or attempted to abstain from, and why?
So I mentioned salt. That's a really interesting one because he changes his mind. It's one of the more dramatic shifts in his own opinion. Early in life, like many people, he doesn't think much about it. He kind of embraces salt as a, you know, delicious variety. You find a couple of instances where he's praising salty foods as a young man. But pretty quickly, as he gets interested in nutrition, he decides that salt is bad for you, and ultimately gets to the point where he decides that you can eliminate it entirely as an additive. So he's very aware that salt exists in dairy products, for example, and many fruits and vegetables. There's small amounts of salt. And so he's aware that he's not cutting out salt entirely, but he believes he can live a healthier life without adding any salt to his food. And he calls this his saltless diet. And will experiment with the saltless diet for many years before eventually deciding that, in fact, it's necessary for him and for all people to have a little bit more salt than that very, very minimum level, while still arguing, and I think rightly, that many of us consume too much salt. So he moves from, at first, sort of embracing the status quo to then being very, very strict and trying to eliminate all added salt to moving towards a more moderate ground, which is actually that part of the book, that research was one of the key questions for me personally in my own life. When I started the book, I really didn't know how I felt about salt. And reading about Gandhi's experiments with it, engagements with it, and also kind of contemporary scientific and nutritional studies have brought me towards a moderate ground where I try to reduce my amount, but I don't go crazy about it. Sugar, on the other hand, is one where studying Gandhi's life, reading nutritional studies, has actually led me to try to be, and I'm not always great at this, but to try to be more austere. And Gandhi would be proud, you know, in that he himself also decided that, unlike salt, which he comes to feel more moderate about, sugar is something that he feels very strongly should be avoided, with some key exceptions. So the biggest one being fruit. He maintains a lifelong passion for fruit, which is an ambivalent passion for him. Sometimes he feels he's actually too passionate about fruit. But overall, throughout his life, he sees fruit as a healthy thing, something that should be a part of his diet. Sugar, on the other hand, he decides fairly early on is both injurious to health and also, interestingly, he feels injurious to spiritual growth. This is a part of Gandhi's diet that I found personally very fascinating, but I couldn't go all the way with him on. And that is that he felt that the more flavorful you made food, the more dangerous it was from a spiritual perspective, the more likely it was to pull you away from a focus on higher goals, particularly spiritual goals. And he inherits this conception from particular spiritual traditions, particularly facets of Jainism and Hinduism. In certain Jain traditions, people eat very purposefully bland food in order to turn their attention and direction towards more spiritual ends. And Gandhi picks up on a lot of that and will often argue that food should not be consumed for the flavor, that focusing on the flavor is a mistake from a spiritual perspective. And yet, he never, all the way through his life, he never entirely gives up on the joys of food. And it's actually that part of Gandhi, that inconsistent part of Gandhi, that I find most attractive personally, as someone who sees the merits in some cases of a certain kind of austerity, but also, you know, likes to eat my mango, just like Gandhi did. I appreciate the way in which he's able to ultimately sort of accept some kind of moderation, sometimes grudgingly, but to just recognize that even something like his prohibition on sugar, you know, can't be maintained absolutely.
Yeah, I was struck too by how often you describe him changing his mind or developing nuance in his thinking as he's gaining more information. And he's really very carefully seeking out lots of nutritional information, as well as kind of searching his own philosophy and his own morality for what he should do. So what else, what strikes you as the most interesting contradictions? Is it about salt or his mango struggles or drinking milk when he would really prefer to be a vegan? What are some of his more interesting contradictions to you?
Well, let me start with the last two that you mentioned, because they're both really great examples. So mangoes, of course, are one of his great passions, but a very difficult, complicated one for him. And there's this wonderful moment in the conclusion of the book, which I called The Mango and the Mahatma, in which I talk about these two episodes where in one, he gets this crate of mangoes and he writes a letter to a very dear friend saying, "Oh, I'm so sorry that you weren't here for me to share these wonderful mangoes with you." And then 20 years later, he gets a crate of mangoes that are sent to help with some patients that Gandhi's helping take care of. And he ends up eating some of them himself, and he curses them. He says they're a cursed fruit because they are so delicious. And I think it's easy to suggest possible reasons why in one case he supports mangoes and in another he doesn't. You know, is it that in one case the mangoes were destined for medical patients he was treating, or is it that he's grown with more austere with age? But in fact, what I found is that he maintains that tension, the tension between loving the flavor of food and seeing it as a danger. He maintains that all the way through his adult life. He never fully reconciles that. And I find that very appealing, again, for me personally, because I really do see both sides. I think there's something very beautiful about eating a delicious meal, eating a delicious mango. And I would never want to give that up. In fact, I would say that there's something spiritually important about the experience of that kind of beauty. It pulls us out of ourselves. It broadens us. It opens us up to a greater world. The subtitle of the book is Eating with the World in Mind. I think flavor can help us actually connect to the world beyond us. But it can also do exactly the opposite. It can also drive us back into ourselves and narrow our realm of interests, particularly if we fall into a certain kind of gluttonous hedonism, which I can say from personal experience, it's often hard to avoid. So I think that tension is very productive. And then in terms of his vegetarianism, veganism, there you see Gandhi really struggling to live ethically with his dietary choices. And he becomes convinced that veganism is the more ethical choice. And yet for a variety of nutritional, particularly digestive reasons, he has a hard time being a vegan. He has a really hard time with beans and lentils. And so he ends up eventually being convinced that he should continue to consume milk, particularly goat's milk, because he vows to never consume any milk and then is able to convince himself that he was just thinking of cows when he made the vow. So he becomes a reluctant vegetarian, really at that point in his life, and remains that way all the way through. I think that's also important. Often with nutritional questions, people can become so confident and so sure of themselves that they close off a certain tolerance to those who aren't so sure. And Gandhi wasn't that way. He could be very firm in his beliefs on something, but then also be able to say, but you know what? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe evidence will change my mind later. Maybe I'm not seeing this in the right way. So he remains tolerant of others, and he maintains a certain kind of openness that I think comes from his own awareness of his own mistakes.
Yeah. On the subject of that openness, one of the things that you praise Gandhi for in the book is his ability to both hold a firm conviction about diet for himself, for instance, the vegetarianism, but to make space for differences of opinions. So, for instance, his Muslim friends who eat beef, you describe it as a kind of dietary pluralism. Do you have any good stories or examples of that kind of openness and how it helped him?
Well, I think probably the best example, it comes from beef eating, because Gandhi was, he was vegetarian, but then he was especially opposed to eating beef on religious grounds. And yet, he very clearly tells his followers that it would be an abomination to physically prevent someone else, whether they be Muslim or Christian or even Hindu, from consuming beef. And that was a very important statement for him to make, because India had in that time, and still sadly in our age now, has certain people that will go to the extreme of being violent in their efforts to prevent others from eating beef, which Gandhi just was very clear about, that you know the goal was to convert people to vegetarianism, to stop them from eating beef through nonviolence, through conversation, through example, not through coercion, and certainly not through violence. And I think this is, more broadly speaking, this is, I think, an example of something that sadly is in great need in our world today, which is people who are willing to say, I believe very strongly that I'm right on this subject, and I'm going to do everything I can to convince you that you're wrong, but I'm not going to kill you. If I can't convince you, I'm not going to kill you. I'm not going to harm you. I'm just going to keep trying to pull you in every nonviolent way I can towards what I think is the truth. Gandhi's vegetarianism, I think, is a beautiful example of that kind of pluralism.
Right. And what we know best about Gandhi is this commitment to nonviolence through political action. Will you describe the connections between that philosophy of nonviolence and his choices in his diet? How does his food choice line up with his political beliefs and actions?
Nonviolence is absolutely the foundation of his diet. And conversely, I would say that studying Gandhi's diet allows us a unique window on his nonviolence. Generally speaking, when people study Gandhi's nonviolence, they tend to approach it from a political perspective. How did he use nonviolent civil disobedience to fight against British imperialism, for example? But in fact, Gandhi understood nonviolence much more broadly and much more deeply. And for him, it was ultimately about a way of life. It was a philosophy of life that involved trying to live every day in a way that was not causing as little harm as possible to other living beings. And I think he actually goes beyond that. Was actively trying to limit the suffering and injustice that existed in the world. So for Gandhi, nonviolence wasn't just about abstaining from committing harm. It was an active force that was that really called him into fighting for social justice. And you see that in his approach to dietary issues. You know, we talked about salt. That's a great example of his diet butting right up into his politics. We talked just now about vegetarianism. Another really powerful example is his fasting. You know, everybody knows that Gandhi fasted. Very few people know just how much he fasted. He fasted a lot and for many different reasons. And almost in every case, the fast was a combination of spiritual religious belief with some kind of larger political goal, whether it was on a local scale, like his famous fast in Calcutta towards the end of his life, or whether it was on a more national scale. Gandhi connected his spirituality, his politics, his physical well-being, because he also fasted for physical health, to his politics through fasting. And I think that even though, you know, I know fasting's it's a complicated subject. We could talk more about the difficulties of knowing how to fast in a healthy way and knowing when too much fasting can become extreme. We haven't talked much yet, but I should say that one of the things that I write a lot about in the book is the way in which Gandhi's obsessions with his diet can cross the, in fact, did cross the border into things that I myself find unhealthy. I think overall, what I took from studying Gandhi's fast is that he was a really beautiful example of a man who was willing to sacrifice his body to try to fight against against imperialism, against religious extremism, to fight for his values, and that I find very admirable.
Yeah. So, what is the link between self-control in terms of diet and abstinence, and self-rule in terms of democracy? One of the things that I found kind of troubling, actually, about this position was the link between healthy bodies and fitness for democracy. And I wondered how, you know, from a disability studies point of view in the present, there might be problems with that. So what are some of your reactions there about self-control and self-rule?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. Let me start with the word Swaraj. This is a very important word for Gandhi. Literally means self-rule, and is often used as an equivalent for independence. But Swaraj does not equate to independence for Gandhi, because independence can mean freedom to do whatever you want. And for Gandhi, self-rule was much more about responsibility. It was about being in the position to be responsible over one's own life, over one's own community, over one's own nation. And there was a tight link for Gandhi between freedom from foreign rule and the right to rule oneself in the appropriate way. And this might sound a little bit Victorian, and it was. It is to some degree about control in a problematic way. And yet, it also led Gandhi to take some stances that I think were very, very important. For example, he says very clearly that Swaraj is not just about getting the British out of India. Swaraj is about building an India where people don't go hungry at night, right? Where women and men are on an equal footing, where there's no such thing as untouchability, right? Where people of different religious communities can live together. So his vision of Swaraj entails a social revolution, not just a change in who happens to be in power in Delhi. And that, I think, is very powerful. He does run into trouble, I think, and I agree with you, when he suggests, and he does this a couple times, that eating right will lead to a certain kind of physical health that will empower people, particularly himself, actually, as an agent of social change. Now, I should say in his defense that I think there is some sort of just basic truth to this, at least in Gandhi's case. If you look at the incredibly strenuous schedule that he set for himself and the remarkable rigors of his life, the fasts are the best example of this. I think there's good evidence that the fact that he kept himself in such good physical health was important to his ability to be such an active agent of positive social change. But it begs the question of how we define health. And I think there's a big danger if we fall into some of our modern misconceptions about what health means. And Gandhi can sadly contribute to that, because he was, of course, obsessed with austerity, with eating less, with fasting, and was extraordinarily skinny. And so you could conclude from Gandhi's life and from some of the things he wrote that being healthy meant being skinny, and that only people who were skinny and able-bodied, right, narrowly defined, would be able to fully contribute to society. I think Gandhi at his best avoids that kind of narrowness. And I think the whole thing hinges on how you understand health. I think at his best, Gandhi challenges us to rethink that. You know, he has one great sentence that I quote in the introduction, if I remember right, where he writes about, you know, being healthy doesn't mean having a weightlifter's body. You know, so he at least he's good on that front. You know, he's not big on pumping iron. But I think when it comes to sort of skinniness and fasting, he's more complicated.
Yeah, earlier you mentioned some of those lines that he might have crossed between a healthy interest and an unhealthy obsession. Can you give another example of that?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, I think fasting is a really good one. Being so extreme with salt intake, I think, is another really good one. Trying to avoid flavors is really good. Let me give you one I haven't talked about yet. It's related to the flavor thing and actually to the eating less thing too. I think, was quite rightly concerned with the proliferation of industrial foods. And in part because of that, and in part out of his sense of austerity, he was big on simplifying the number of foods that he ate and would often take vows to eat only 5 items of food per day. And an item of food included something like salt, for example. And so, his diet could be very, very austere. He would have, yogurt, almonds, a little salt, some oranges, and some, leafy greens, for example. That would constitute the limit of what he could eat in that day. And I actually admire very much Gandhi's opposition to industrial foods, his general skepticism towards processed foods in general, and his desire to simplify his diet. All of that I admire and actually try to employ in my own life in various ways. But I think he took it too far. I do. There are some times when I make a salad which has 16 things in it, or a stew where I'm just throwing in every vegetable I have in my fridge, where I think to myself, actually, it's good sometimes to eat a great variety of things. I think sometimes he does go too far in trying to strip down to the basic minimum the number of things he ate at any one time.
Right. And that link between pleasure or the sort of abstinence from pleasure is not one I could get behind. but it also seems like another one of those contradictory struggles where he has this pride in his Indian culture and Indian cuisine, but it is a very flavorful cuisine.
Yes. Yes.
Talk a little bit more about that.
Well, he maintains a love for Indian food all the way through his life. I mean, several of his comfort foods are foods that he grew up eating in his native Gujarat. There's a rice and lentil dish that he asks for often, even late in life, that usually was prepared with quite a number of delicious spices. And I don't actually have good evidence. I've never seen him purposely tell someone not to make it that way. So I wouldn't be surprised if even in his more austere moments, he's willing to make some exceptions for those sorts of comfort foods. I'm with you on that. I mean, as I said, I think you can understand, at least I can understand, where being austere for perhaps certain periods of your life, right? Maybe taking a time, some people, do this during certain religious moments, whether it's, Lent or in the Hindu calendar, actually, there are times where Gandhi would purposefully cut out certain foods or purposely fast. I can see some merit to austerity within limits, but I also myself find that pleasure can be a very spiritually ennobling thing. It can bring us out of ourselves. And I think there's few better examples of this than Indian cooking itself. I often thought to myself when I was studying Gandhi, he would have done much better with his diet if he was living, let's say, in the American Midwest, Pittsburgh has pretty good food these days. I'm not so much talking about Pittsburgh, but sort of, if he grew up where my grandmother grew up in Southern Illinois, where, the foods were bland and basic and most vegetables came from a can, then maybe being austere with his diet would have been more called for. But yeah, in the land of Palak Paneer, which is one of my favorite foods of all time, or, all the amazing things that come out of Indian kitchens. And we should say, of course, Indian food, this, and I'm sure most of our listeners do too. There isn't even just one kind of Indian food. There's so many different kinds of Indian food. Every region of India has its own, culinary masterpieces. For India to produce such an austere man as Gandhi is quite an interesting paradox.
You describe a lot of Gandhi's diet experiments as failures, right? So in the chapter on salt, he limits the salt in his diet, not just for his own health, but as a political action. And that political action doesn't seem to be successful, right? He failed to be a vegan. He failed to maintain his raw diet, which I'd love to hear you talk about a little bit more. What are some of the significance of these failures?
Oh, I think the failures inspire his tolerance. They inspire his ability to respect others who have failed. I think if Gandhi was the kind of person who decided to eat a certain way and then stuck to that for the rest of his life, he'd be a much less interesting figure. One thing, he'd be less, he'd be less like all of us. I mean, I think most people in the world can really sympathize with someone who experiments with a variety of different diets and often fails. I think that's part of what it means to be human, and it's certainly part of what it means to be human with food. And I think it inspires Gandhi's tolerance and also makes it much easier for us to connect with him.
Yeah. Will you talk more about his raw diet? What inspired that and how did it turn out?
Yes. So Gandhi is inspired by a nutritional belief that cooking food destroys or wastes various nutrients. This is a belief that's very common amongst vegetarians in his day, and actually still has many advocates in our world today. And I can talk more about my own views on that. It's another part of the book where I learned a lot actually from doing the research. So he has nutritional grounds for eating raw. He also has some social and political grounds for eating raw. He believes that it will help women who are disproportionately forced in many cases to spend long hours in the kitchen. I was a little wary of in these sections of Gandhi's archive, because sometimes he can make assumptions about what cooking means for women. I think sometimes he's not aware of just how many women and men, for that sake, can actually really enjoy time in the kitchen. But I also think he's right that there are many cases where women in particular, particularly in India and Gandhi's day, were not given options, right, and were required to spend long hours cooking. So he sees some social political merits to raw food, and then he tries it. And he tries it at a couple different points. One of my favorite documents that I draw upon is actually a diary that he makes during one of these raw food experiments. And he's very candid about the struggle. He finds it very difficult to maintain the diet because of the toll that it takes on his body, and he ends up abandoning it. He never holds on to a raw diet for super long. I will say one thing in defense of those who advocate raw diets in our world today, and I have a good friend who's spent a lot of time eating raw. Gandhi's options were quite limited. There were many key pillars of contemporary raw food diets that Gandhi didn't have access to for one reason or another. And so I bet he could have done much better with a raw food diet, actually, if he lived, in a city like Pittsburgh today. But I also think some of it had to do with the other constraints that Gandhi put on himself in his diet. So if you add up all the different ways that he was limiting himself, I think it became quite hard for him to sustain a raw food diet.
You connect especially his raw diet to today's paleo diet and some other trends that we've talked about, nut milks. We can talk about that some more too. What problems or issues or questions about diet did Gandhi face that we're still dealing with today? What do you think he has to offer us now? Is he a story of wisdom or a story of caution or some of both?
Oh, he's both. Yeah, he's definitely both. The caution and the wisdom often collide. So for example, I think studying Gandhi's diet is a wonderful way to be cautioned about believing that any one diet will solve all the problems. I think there's still a very strong tendency in our world that's driven in large part by money, right? By trying to sell books and sell diets, to tell people, aha, you're struggling with this, that, or the other. Well, come and do this diet. Right, whether it's the paleo diet or, various kinds of fasting diets, or there's so many kind of get healthy quick schemes out there that that I think can lead people to be really hard on themselves, for one thing, when things don't live up to their hopes and expectations. People can take it as a personal failure. And can lead people to a certain kind of extremism or absolutism. And that's where Gandhi's both a cautionary note, but also I think an example for us, because even though he could be quite absolute and extreme in certain moments and in certain times, I think taken as a whole, he's an example of someone who really believed in evidence-based diets, in recognizing limitations, recognizing failures, owning up to them, and being humble. And let me give you another example. He had a long standing debate with a few different British nutritional scientists who work for the empire. And here's Gandhi, you know, writing from this, in many ways, radical position, both politically and nutritionally. And yet, Gandhi is able to accept on more than one occasion when his views on particular kind of food or vitamin were wrong. Vitamins are actually a fascinating thing for Gandhi because our knowledge of vitamins was just growing at the time when Gandhi was most interested in nutrition. And early on, he believed, for example, that he could get vitamin D from various food sources. And, you know, it's only after being told by the scientists that, no, actually you get vitamin D from exposure to the sun, Gandhi accepts that. He embraces it and he changes his opinion. I have a chapter in the book on diet and health, because so many of Gandhi's approaches to food were filtered through his conceptions of health and medicine. And he was a big practitioner of traditional Indian forms of medicine, particularly Ayurveda. And yet he was also a huge critic of particular approaches to Ayurveda that were unwilling to be humble, unwilling to recognize that maybe that particular practitioner, that particular diet didn't have all the answers. So he's willing to buck the norm, to be radical, to experiment, and all of those things I think are positive. And then he's willing to accept when maybe he's wrong. And that I think is also positive. So I think we can learn from his strengths and from his weaknesses. I certainly have learned from both.
Yeah. Are there things that you've changed about your diet since you've done this project?
Yes. Although I should preface my answer by saying that I'm wary of suggesting that I learned something from Gandhi, put it into practice in my life, and now everything's better. That actually falls right into that trap we were just talking about. You know, so I would say I still certainly have my dietary and culinary struggles. I had them before I started my research. It's part of why I did my research, and the research helped me understand them better and helped me make some real significant changes, but it hasn't solved all my problems. You know, it's an ongoing struggle for me as it was for Gandhi. I'd say the biggest success, and you know, if my wife was here, she could validate this or maybe complicate it because I'm still working on it. But I think I've gotten better at being relaxed as a father around issues of food. You know, I think in the first few years when we had kids, I was all too quick to try to use my nutritional knowledge or what I thought I knew about nutrition to get my kids to eat especially healthy things. And of course, you know, when you have little kids, they often resist that. They want to eat what they want to eat. And I was one of those fathers who would often get quite stressed and tense because, you know, my daughter wasn't eating her edamame or, you know, my son wasn't eating his spinach, although he actually loves spinach. You know, he wasn't eating his broccoli. And that was a mistake. It took me a long time to see that as a mistake. I'm still working on it. And part of why it's so hard is because, of course, you do want to care about what your kids eat. You do want to care about what anyone you love eats. And you, as a parent, you can't just give up entirely on trying to teach them how to eat healthily and trying to help them eat healthy foods. So you have to try to find a middle ground. I think everyone has their own approach to that middle ground. I certainly don't claim to have figured it out in any way. But reading about Gandhi's struggles in his own diet and also as a father, you know, Gandhi could be very, very authoritarian as a father and very demanding of his children. It helped me relax a bit. And it helped me loosen up. I've become more moderate with salt. I mentioned that. I've become a little bit more strict with sugar, although I'm still working on that. You know, I vowed to never have dessert, and then I think like 3 hours later had a dessert. And in fact, that case is actually telling because it was a free dessert. One of my big weaknesses is that I am terrible with free food. I just cannot resist. Even if I'm totally full, even if I don't like the food, if someone offers me something free, which, you know, of course happens all the time on a university campus, it's very hard for me to say no. And Gandhi writes about this. You know, he writes actually about how we should be more thoughtful in when we try to force food on other people, because we often think we're being nice to them, but in many cases we're not. You know, in many cases we're actually putting them in an awkward position where they feel like they have to eat something they don't want to eat. So, you know, my, I don't know if this is a Gandhian solution or not, but I've been actually starting to carry around like a little Ziploc bag, because often I just can't say no, but if I have a Ziploc bag, at least I can like stick whatever it is in the Ziploc bag and hopefully eat it later when I'm hungry. You know, so is it, I'm trying. It's not easy. You know, it wasn't easy for Gandhi. I don't think it's easy for any of us. I think what's one of the most fun things about writing the book and I hope about reading it is that I hope that readers will see in Gandhi, not a teacher who will say, here's what you should do, X, Y, and Z, but rather, you know, a sort of a friend who's struggling in this with you. And so you can say, aha, well, maybe I'll learn this from Gandhi, maybe I'll learn that from Gandhi. But the biggest thing, at least I've taken, is just to try to be humble and try to be kind to myself, even as I'm trying to improve.
Yeah. So on a personal note, I am a scholar of cookbooks and recipes, and I was surprised to find that there are recipes at the end of this book. And some of them come from Gandhi, from the archive, and some of them are your own, kind of using Gandhi's ingredients. Why did you choose to include recipes at the end?
Oh, I had to. I couldn't resist. I mean, for one thing, because I don't want this to just be an intellectual exercise for readers. I think that would be a waste. My biggest hope is that this book will help people act differently in their relationship to food, and that might mean eating food that people find healthier for themselves, that makes them feel better in their bodies. It I hope will also mean helping people think about how to eat more ethically and to eat in a way that is better for the farmers who are producing the food, the people who are picking it, people who are transporting it. You know, I hope the book can help inspire people to action. And what better form or way of doing that than providing a couple, you know, recipes that people might put into practice. Some of those recipes, as you said, are things I took directly from Gandhi. For example, how he made almond milk. And you know, first he starts with an almond jelly that he can eat. You could turn it into an almond butter, and then you can make it an almond milk. So it's versatile. And others are things that I have come to love. That I see as at least, you know, if not of Gandhian origin, at least in accordance with Gandhian philosophy.
Well, I'll try one of those out, I promise.
Yes, I recommend them all.
Great. So what kind of projects are you working on now? For a person who just put out two books this year, you're allowed to take a break if you'd like to. But what's next?
So, you know, I really love what I do. It's one of the great joys of my life is that I'm able to do things that I really love. And so I kind of already dove into some new historical projects. I'm working on a book about the civil rights movement, and particularly about the role of learning in the civil rights movement. How did civil rights activists learn to do the things they do? How did they learn to sit on a stool and let people pour coffee on them or put cigarettes on them or hit them and maintain nonviolence in that context? What did that mean for them, and how did they help teach that to other people and pull other people in the movement? So that project's really been meaningful. I've also started this very early days. You might be the first person I've said this to, but I've actually started taking some notes on kind of a food memoir. I wrote a book about my older brother that ended up being a memoir that hasn't been published yet. I'm kind of in the last stages of editing that one. And I loved writing that book for many reasons, because I love my brother, but also because it was a book that I learned a lot from, actually, just like the Gandhi book. And so I started taking notes on writing a book about food and fatherhood. So as I said, you know, it's a place where I'm actively struggling, trying to get better, trying to learn. How do you be someone who cares so much about food and nutrition and cares so much about your kids and yet can relax when all they want to eat is macaroni and cheese, or, you know, they want to buy a popsicle at the park or something? So I've just started taking notes on that. I don't know what form that will take, but it's been helpful for me to start thinking about those ideas in that way.
In addition to your academic work, you're also the founder and director of the Bajaj Rural Development Lab and socialchange101.org. Do you want to talk a little bit about those projects and how they connect?
Sure. They both have a Gandhian link, actually. So the Bajaj Lab is a collaboration with a really remarkable group of people in central India and Wardha. They're based very close to Gandhi's last ashram. You know, Gandhi sets up in Wardha in the middle of his life, and that's his home base all the way until he's assassinated. And this group of people, the Kamalnayan Jamnalal Bajaj Foundation, they're operating with money that is from the Bajaj family. And Jamnalal Bajaj was one of Gandhi's most important financial supporters and was the main reason why Gandhi comes to Wardha in the first place. So they have this wonderful historical connection to Gandhi, and they also have a contemporary connection in that they're really trying to bring his ideas to practice by fighting against poverty and other social wrongs in the Wardha area and doing really remarkable things with it. The Bajaj Lab is primarily an educational effort to help people learn about and from the work that the Bajaj Foundation is doing in India, because they're doing so many incredible things in terms of water management, alternative energy sources, organic farming, and helping farmers in a part of India where there's a lot of poverty and with climate change, a lot of instability. That's a Bajaj Lab. Socialchange101.org is a free open access online course on the history of social movements and social change. And we also run a series of workshops where we go and work primarily with high school kids. We've done it with other groups too. Where we try to help young people particularly think through what are the issues that they care most about in their communities, in their country, in the world, and then how they can get involved. And we use history, but we also use a lot of art. I'm a big believer in art as a form of social change and as a way of helping people think about social change. So we help students create video projects or to engage in other forms of art as a way to help empower them as agents of social change.
Do either of those projects intersect with food justice?
I hope so. So both do tangentially, but I like them even more strongly. So in the case of the Bajaj Lab, a lot of the work they do, basically all the work they do is with farmers. And a lot of the work they do is actually particularly with crops, diversifying crops, helping farmers cut back or eliminate industrial inputs, move towards various forms of organic farming. And so there's a strong food dimension to it. And if you factor in the sort of ways in which they're trying to empower low-income folks, I'd say there's also a food justice component to it. On the social change 101 side to it, the website has a variety of different projects that we've done with local artists and with high school groups and others. And one of the key portals, one of the key ways in, is through Rachel Carson. So you teach at Chatham. Of course, Rachel Carson is a distinguished alum of Chatham University, who is a very important figure in the environmental movement, author of Silent Spring. I expect many listeners will know this stuff already. But we actually have some great resources for anyone who wants to go a little deeper with Rachel Carson's life and work. A variety of different tools that can help people learn more about Carson and connect her and her legacy to various questions in our world today, not just environmentalism, but also issues of gender and sexuality and other struggles that Carson was involved in.
Well, we could certainly talk about this great book all day. Again, the book is Gandhi's Search for the Perfect Diet, Eating with the World in Mind. Thank you so much, Nico, for talking with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Carrie. This has been a real joy.